ends. The good point is that the aerial vehicle does not make too much noise, therefore it does not scare away animals.
So what I do is I fly infrared drones primarily at night over disaster areas after a hurricane or a fire hits, and I look for people's pets, whether it be cats or dogs, and I also look for injured wildlife. And then either I or rescue crews will go in and rescue the animals after I spot the animals after these natural disasters.
Thron has so far rescued hundreds of stranded animals in various places in the US and Australia. Emergency services have allowed him to participate in rescue efforts after making sure that the drone works well to achieve its goal.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
A video has gone viral showing animals at a U.S. zoo enjoying their bath time becoming clean as a new pimp. Keepers at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo washed the animals to celebrate International Bath Day. From anteaters to rhinos all got sprayed with a water hose. They seemed to love their bath time as it kept them cool in the summer heat. Zoo officials say the occasion is to honor ancient Greek scientist Archimedes, who made a discovery while in the bath. You might be pleased to know life is going back to normal as countries around the world are easing coronavirus restrictions. Disneyland in the French capital of Paris is saying bonjour to visitors once again with all necessary precautions. Bet everyone missed that. The theme park reopened its doors to the public with limited tickets and an online reservation system. All visitors over 6 years old are required to wear face masks and to observe social distancing guidelines. New attractions, including a hotel and various car rides, are also available for guests. Disneyland Paris was shut for over 7 months due to rising COVID-19 infections. This is the first time since January 2020 that all the six Disney resorts are open. Children have their own ways of remembering the dead. In Gaza, Palestinian kids fly kites in memory of their peers who lost their lives in the recent Israeli onslaught. Dozens of kids participated in the event, holding kites bearing the pictures of 66 little victims. According to the organizers, the goal was to send a message to people around the world that Palestinian kids have the right to live a free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only five. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping,
pushing palm and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she has inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Masked Zionist troops will still terrorize Palestinian children in the middle of the night, but new military jargon will hide the true purpose, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled, Israeli regime's night raids on Palestinian families aren't over. Please stay tuned for the second part of the article. Even some former Zionist troops understand that the intelligence gathering rationales for these invasions are bogus. Several told the human rights groups that the intelligence supposedly gained from these operations was never put to later use. None could identify a database where the information was being stored. Even if the mapping raids were primarily about collecting the information, the army has far more effective means to spy on and control the Palestinian population in the occupied territories of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The job of Unit 8200, one of the Israeli regime's military many intelligence gathering arms, includes listening in on Palestinian communications to find secrets that can be used to blackmail and extort Palestinians to collaborate with occupation authorities. A so-called cyber unit in Israeli regime's so-called justice ministry is tasked with spying on Palestinians' internet and social media communications. And the Zionist regime has endless other sources of intelligence on Palestinians. Collaborators, the Palestinian Population Registry that it controls, biometric identity documents, face recognition technology, questioning at checkpoints, the use of drones, and the seizure of Palestinians for interrogation. More importantly, the army knows that it can continue as before with these home invasions by using other pretexts. It will subsume mapping operations within even more violent categories of night raids, such as the search for weapons, interrogations of children, about stoning, throwing, or arrest. Sadly, the Zionist regime courts have always shown a willingness to collude with the Zionist regime army in precisely these kinds of face-saving deceptions and cynical manipulations of language. There is no reason to believe that the Israeli regime legal system will do anything in practice to ensure that home invasions, whether for mapping or any other purpose, come to an end. The record of the Zionist regime courts has been consistently dismal in protecting Palestinians from Israeli regime army abuses. Even when the courts do belatedly rule against army protocols that flagrantly violate international law, the army invariably finds ways to undercut the ruling, usually with the court's complicity. For years, the army has continued to use Palestinians as human shields, dragging out legal proceedings by recharacterizing the practice as a so-called neighbor procedure or prior warning. It is not hard to imagine that intel mapping could be given a similar linguistic makeover. And there is an additional reason to be skeptical. More than 20 years ago, the Zionist regime top court banned the torture of Palestinian detainees, yet it continued almost unabated because the court created a loophole for cases defined as ticking bombs, when interrogators supposedly faced the race against time to extract information to save lives. After the ruling, it seemed that every Palestinian seized by the army became a ticking bomb. Finally, in 2017, the court reversed its 1999 ruling when it permitted torture as long as interrogators did not cross a threshold of pain that it declined to determine in advance. The reality is that when the Zionist regime treats its occupation as permanent, then preserving the occupation's infrastructure for surveillance, control, intimidation, and humiliation becomes an absolute necessity. When the occupier additionally seeks to drive out Palestinians to replace them with its own settler population, the rot runs deeper still. Palestinian men, women, and children are reduced to nothing more than pieces to be swept off a chessboard. For that reason, home invasions, the terrorizing of families in the middle of the night by masked troops will continue, whatever euphemism is used to justify it. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Welcome to Leith, directed by Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and the Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Marcel Cartier, who's an independent journalist and a hip-hop recording artist. Now, Welcome to Leith is a documentary that chronicles the takeover of a tiny town called Leith in North Dakota, a Midwestern state in the US, by the notorious white supremacist Craig Cobb, who buys up the land to create a sanctuary for his followers and terrorizes the local residents. When Cobb's takeover plans become evident, the small community rallies to save their town from Cobb's band of white supremacists, and the two groups clash over their ideals for the place they call home.
First got here, he turned around and asked me if we have any land for sale.
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here. That's white Americans hating on us, who are also white Americans.
They simply will not allow us to keep one another's company freely and openly.
If we weren't getting harassed so much, we wouldn't have to do this.
Tom and Dutton both have rifles!
You're running us out of this damn town!
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So that was the Welcome to Leith trailer. And I must say, this documentary gives you a really chilling insight into far-right extremism in the US and also raises many questions about this notion of American do-it-yourself ideals. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this film?
It's a really, really well-made documentary. And what I liked about it was that it doesn't put the bad guys into a corner. It lets them talk and express themselves, and they become kind of weirdly flesh and blood people. You can't just vilify them, which makes them even more kind of insidious. It's very well made. It puts you right in the middle of the situation. You feel everything, and it's really very gripping
indeed.
Yeah, and the characters in it, you know, that main guy, Craig Cobb, with the crazy hair, is one of the most riveting people you've seen on film in a long time, in any kind of film, and he's just terrifying. Because the things that come out of his mouth, which they couldn't put in the trailer, are really horrifying.
And so. Marcel, if I could turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ever more relevant in the age of Trump, where people such as Commander Jeff Shupp of the National Socialist Movement, who's very prevalent in this film because he actually owns, I believe, to this day, some of the land that Craig Cobb had actually purchased, you know, in creating this or trying to create this white supremacist community. And of course, the NSM and Shupp were so involved in the Charlottesville protest, mm-hmm. the so-called Unite the Right protest, in which an anti-fascist protester was killed. And Donald Trump, he seems to embolden these type of figures today. You know, under Barack Obama, it was a very different situation, but I think we also saw a situation during the Obama presidency where a lot of these white supremacists used the fact that there was the first black president to say, okay, well, we're losing our country. And actually, the KKK and other groups like this use that as a tremendous recruiting tool. But in the age of Trump, it's just become so much more mainstream. These people feel like they can essentially come out of the closet, say, do whatever they want, and they'll kill actually with impunity almost. And it's very terrifying.
And I just wanted to ask you, Marcel, following from that clip, IndieWire, the film review website, said that Welcome to Leith is a, quote, stunning portrait of First Amendment rights pushed to their extremes. What does it mean by this, and what do you think?
Right, well, the so-called, you know, freedom of speech, being able to say the most sort of hate-filled things and get away with that. I think what's very interesting about the film, actually, is that you see that very small town. There's only one black resident, as far as I know, and he, you know, is very prevalent in the film.
I feel really scared for him, I think.
Yeah. You know, people are absolutely terrified. But, you know, what's also very interesting is that the majority of the residents who are actually white, they also feel terrified by this white supremacist group. They don't feel as if, you know, they have anything in common with them. So, you know, it shows you just how, on the one hand, alienating these type of people can be, even to the white community. And, you know, we often talk about how rural America is a very racist place, and perhaps to some extent that's true, but you also see this white community pushing back against these white supremacists, along with, you know, of course, when there's the protests, you have the indigenous communities from Standing Rock coming and protesting as well.
We're going to delve into those scenes a bit later on, and just going to move on briefly for now.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
It would be extraordinarily beautiful when people enter the town, because we will have floodlit flags of all of the formerly white nations of Europe.
Cobb says like-minded people with white nationalist organizations will be taking up residence on his properties, so they'll have the majority of votes to take over the town.
What we're trying to do is move people into an area where they can get jobs at $50,000 a year almost immediately.
Cobb has a plan that, as crazy as it sounds, might actually happen.
He purchased one parcel and another parcel, and he finally got up to 12 to 13 parcels of land. He had the whole town mapped out as to what he was going to build on each piece of land that he owns, and after I see the map, it was very scary.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights within the United States.
Rich, I want to talk about Craig Cobb a little bit more in this section. We've talked about the general issues. What did you make of his character?
Well, I mean, he's just a fascinating character because he's kind of this insidious villain. And he finds this tiny little town that has 24 residents. It's a tiny place. And he just quietly starts buying up all the land. And he's going to move all of his white supremacist buddies in so that they have a majority and they can take it over legally and become, you know, the politicians of this neighborhood, which would give them a foothold in the state government. And I mean, it's quite a terrifying thing when you look at what they're planning to do.
This town in North Dakota, Leith, it's, you get this overwhelming sense by his presence. It's so secluded, and I think the cinematography of the film was really well done. Did you have any thoughts on that as well?
No, it's very well shot because it really portrays this town as being this tiny, tiny little place. There's also a lot of jobs in the area because of all the fracking that goes on and the oil company in the vicinity. So that's another thing he's looking at. He's thinking, we can bring all of these people here. They have jobs. They have a place that they can take over politically. Mm-hmm. So there are jobs. It's not like it's a horribly depressed area. But it's people basically who just don't want to live in a city or even a town. I mean, this isn't really a town. 24 people, is, you can hardly call it a town. Mm-hmm. But it's, so you get this guy, this kind of crazy-haired, very sly. He's got a sense
quite
of humor.
Quite narcissistic.
He's got a sense of humor. He's very witty and kind of dry. And he's, you know, and you just don't trust him the second you see him. And no one in the town does either. They all think, what's he up to? And then when they see what he's up to, they respond to it.
And I think it's really disturbing how self-aware he is, actually, and his racism. He's quite proud of that fact. Marcel, what did you make of his character in this documentary?
It's very interesting, and actually, just based on what you said right there, you know, when you see somebody like Craig Cobb, before he cuts the hair off, he looks insidious, and he looks crazy, and he looks scary. But then when we see him towards the end, and he's clean-shaven, and he seems to be such a reasonable person. You have to think to yourself, you know, how many people are there in society that we may meet on a daily basis, especially in the United States or rural America, and perhaps they harbor these same sort of white supremacist views. And, you know, it makes me think of the so-called alt-right and this rebranding of white supremacy, this rebranding of fascism and hatred under this, you know, more mainstream banner. So, you know, it's perhaps easy to look at somebody like Craig Cobb and say, okay, well, that guy's a racist and that guy's a nut job. But they understand very well how to tap into the, you know, the desires and the frustrations and the dissatisfactions, I think, of white people in, you know, working class America. And that's the scariest part.
Early on in the film, he's talking about genocide. He's talking about,
right,
we're being genocided. The white people were all being killed off, which is just ridiculous. And he's saying we need to kill all the Jews. I mean, he says that
in the film. I was going to ask, how can he say that?
Actually, those words come out of his mouth, and you just think, he says this on camera, and you're kind of shocked. Later on, he's very reasonable, and he's talking about balance in society, and you think, ooh, he's still the same man,
right,
but he's now learned how to use the media,
exactly,
and how to present himself as a more reasonable person, which is really terrifying.
And I want to pick up a point you made, actually, Marcel. Mm-hmm. We learned from the documentary that Cobb came from quite a decent upbringing. His mother was a teacher. His father was a rich land developer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes you think, how could someone from that sort of upbringing, not that there's any excuse for racism or to explain it, but how could he harbor so much hatred?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, like the white supremacist notions that are prevalent in this film and that, you know, Cobb holds dear, I mean, you know, the United States was created off the genocide of the indigenous people. The United States was built on slavery. So, you know, these are very American concepts, actually. And, you know, for the economic situation in particular to be changing in the United States, where, of course, the gap between the rich and the poor is becoming wider, the middle class is eroding. This is exactly what Donald Trump tapped into in the electoral campaign. You know, if you look at the areas that he, you know, campaigned in and places that he actually won huge support, a lot of it was among the white working class, you know, where jobs are perhaps no longer existent in certain communities, deindustrialization, jobs going abroad. And this is something that Cobb talks about. He says, well, look, you know, we'll have people move into this community and they'll immediately be given jobs, you know, with a salary of $50,000. So there's a substantial economic component to all of this, where it's saying, okay, well, you know, the situation in the country is quite bad at the moment economically. You know, come here and, you know, you can live this this fantastic life, and, you know, we can have
the American
white
dream,
Aryan
the
society.
White American
that,
dream.
Exactly.
Exactly.
We'll be taking our country back, in other words.
Now, that was a really interesting point.
members of the activist group Anti-Racist Action have ties to North Dakota and are planning to rally around the town of Leith and force Cobb out.
When there's lives at stake and when the integrity of your community is at stake, it's time to stand up.
Our lives should not have to change because of one guy's agenda.
You know, it's really funny because millions of whites have been driven out of their neighborhoods and cities by violence. And here we just have democracy in the hands of driving south.
A strong showing of support for Leith coming from North Dakota's Native Americans, who came here angry and ready to take on Craig Cobb and members of the National Socialist Movement.
You represent a dying cause.
We got one thing to say to you.
I think the town shows remarkable solidarity and restraint against Cobb and his gang. Rich, what did you make of the community's response?
Well, I mean, they were terrified. Once they realized what was going on, they were really terrified. And there's one of the neighbors who lives just across the field who has a past. The film kind of goes into his past where he had a horrific experience when he lived in Washington.
His daughter was murdered,
and he's moved out here to try to get away from that and rebuild his life. And now all of this comes in next door to him. And you see him buying guns and giving guns to his wife and, you know, terrified for his kids. He won't let them stay in the house alone. And you get the sense of what it must feel like to have someone like that living next door and just the feeling, well, especially when they're walking around with giant rifles all the time. Mm. And the town kind of gets really freaked out. And it's quite nice that the people from the neighboring town kind of come to their rescue, basically, because there's just 24 of them. They don't even have a police force. They use the sheriff, the county sheriff. And the county sheriff and his deputy are quite featured heavily, and they keep coming into the rescue as well. Mm. So it's nice that they get a lot of support from the surrounding neighborhood. You know, people realize that this tiny little community is in jeopardy, and everyone comes to help them.
And it's good that the filmmakers gave us access equally to Cobb and also the community and some of their stories. And Marcel, do you think the community acted in an appropriate way?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the main things that we see from that response was the multinational unity that's very prevalent. Again, you have the Standing Rock community, which has been in the news heavily over the past few years because of the Dakota Access Pipeline and intruding on their territory. So we've had the huge resistance at Standing Rock. So we see not just the immediate community, but we see the wider community, so to speak, rallying against these hateful elements. And although, yes, we're seeing a resurgence and, you know, a sort of coming out of the closet of these white supremacists in society today, we also see that there is a lot of resistance to this taking place in the U.S.
But going back to the film, that was a really good point. We see that the community kind of struggle against Cobb, and Cobb seems to have he asserts his rights and he has police protection. I mean, how does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. Just in the past few months, the FBI has put out reports about the domestic terror threat. When you talk about domestic terrorism, because of course all of the focus on so-called terrorism in the United States is always about so-called Islamist terrorism, and actually these people are a much bigger threat to U.S. society. You know, but in the FBI report, they're actually putting on par so-called black identity extremists, as they call it. So in other words, the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-racist activists, they're putting them on par with these white supremacists, which is exactly what Trump did when he said, well, what about the so-called alt-left, in response to the alt-right? It's like, as if, you know, these very terrifying racists who walk around with these huge rifles, I think the term sexy rifles is used in the film, is somehow, you know, equivalent with people pushing back against that and struggling for equality. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But
there's no comparison. The right-wingers are threatening violence. They're going in proposing violence.
Right.
And verbally, they're saying we're coming in to, you know, blood's going to run down the streets. I mean, that's what they say.
And could you imagine?
Sorry to pause you there. We're just going to move on. We'll continue the discussion.
It began with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center has stalked me for about 7 years. This is literally the fourth time via which they or their operatives have done this to me. That is, stalked me, gotten me fired, gotten me evicted, gotten me run out of countries even. I'm not young. You know, I'm an older guy. So why don't they say, just leave this cantankerous kind of a odd fellow alone? No, they're not going to do that, you see. For some reason, they simply will not allow the infinitesimal few of us that there are to keep one another's company freely and openly.
In the early 2000s, the federal government was cracking down on white supremacists, and there was a high-level U.S. Attorney task force that was created to deal with that threat. The last time they were supposed to meet was actually on 9/11. The federal government turned on a dime very quickly for obvious reasons and focused almost all of its attention on Islamic extremism. Therefore, the government was left with no intelligence agencies fighting back against the kinds of groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks. That's pretty serious. You know, there's a few hundred thousand of these people in the United States. Some of them, in the vein of Cobb, are willing to use weapons in ways that are dangerous. Some of them are willing to kill.
So there we saw Cobb with his hair cut and almost unrecognizable. And I want to talk about the wider issues now in the film. I think this part of the documentary was one of the most eye-opening parts. We see that after the advent of 9/11, that there was more of a crackdown on Muslims than white supremacists. Marcel, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been the dominant theme of counterterrorism in the United States since 9/11, definitely. And, you know, I think it's just come to the surface again in the past maybe year or 2 years that, well, there's actually, you know, a vast number of white supremacists who are willing to, as she said, they're kill. And, you know, like, you can see Cobb walking around in the streets with these huge rifles. I mean, could you imagine for a second this being two African Americans and the police having the same sort of response to them? You know, basically, like, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, you're just going to go home. All right, fine, sir, please go on your way. And then they get arrested afterwards, of course. But, you know, we know very well that if this was an African American, you know, pair walking in the streets, that they would probably be gunned down by those same police officers, right? So, you know, you can see the relationship between Cobb and the white nationalists and the police forces and the authorities and powers that be as well. And I think that's such an important part of this documentary.
And Rich, if I could turn to you, we saw actually in the film that Kylan Dutton, one of Cobb's supporters in the film, he says that white children under the age of 5 are now the minority in the U.S. for the first time, and he's concerned about this. And do you think that they go to leave as a sort of sense of sanctuary, that they're under attack and they're being victimized?
Yeah, I don't think that statistic is true. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But they're going there thinking, oh, we're under attack. You know, us white people are, you know, we're the persecuted. That's never been true, obviously, and it's not been true in history. And I don't know why they feel like they're under attack. I think, I don't know. I can't.
Do you think it would have been good to explore that a bit more?
You listen to them talk, and you think it's very rare that I hear someone talk, and I can't put my mind. You know, I can't see the situation through their eyes. And this guy, Kynan, was, and his wife is in the film as well. They talk, they're quite reasonable, they're quite articulate, but I can't identify with anything they say. I can't sit there and say, oh, I see your point, because their point is just, it's just warped, it's wrong, and I don't know if they're, obviously they're just living in their circle of friends, and they have news that they're believing, and they're not really paying attention to what's actually happening in the world.
It raises many questions, yes, and we get little glimpses into their lives.
And I think it's interesting in the film that, you know, it basically is a First Amendment issue, and America is unusual that hate speech is not illegal in America. It's protected. So people can say the most horrifying things. They can fly their swastikas, which you can't do in Europe. You can't say those things in Europe. But you can say them there, and it's a different legal situation. So that's why you watch it, and it's for a European especially, it's really horrifying to see, because you couldn't do that in Europe.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there on that note, and please do watch this documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you, and don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
It is now full 40 years since the martyrdom of the great revolutionary figure, Chief Justice Ayatollah Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, along with 72 high-ranking officials, including parliament members and cabinet ministers, by traitors on the payroll of the U.S., thinking that such dastardly acts of terrorism would bring about the collapse of the Islamic Republic system of government in Iran. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Martyr Beheshti's Vision Continues to Guide Iran to the Horror of the U.S. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is now full 40 years since the martyrdom of the great revolutionary figure, Chief Justice Ayatollah Mohammad Hosseini Beheshti, along with 72 high-ranking officials, including parliament members and cabinet ministers, by traitors on the payroll of the U.S., thinking that such dastardly acts of terrorism would bring about the collapse of the Islamic Republic system of government in Iran. Today, the American criminals still pursue the same stale policy of terrorism, the latest prominent victim being General Qasem Soleimani. But the dynamic system of velayat-e-faqih, or governance of the supreme jurisprudent, whose constitution was mainly drafted by Ayatollah Beheshti, has gone from strength to strength, undeterred by the U.S. floods. His famous words that bear testimony to Washington's devilish nature, which can never be changed, contrary to the misconstrued expectations of the naive and the knaves, continue to ring in our ears. U.S., be angry with us and die in the state of anger. Indeed, demise is writ large on the face of the U.S., which, having been kicked out of the sacred soil of Iran in 1979, is desperately trying to linger in our region, when it is only a matter of time before it would be driven out of Iraq, Syria, Arabia, Bahrain, and other places, including Afghanistan, thanks to the immortal legacy of the martyrs of Iran, whom American agents had assassinated on the assumption of the killing the Islamic Revolution. No wonder. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had pronounced those immortal words on June 28, 1981, on hearing the tragic news of the martyrdom of his dedicated student. Beheshti was a nation himself unto our nation. Yes, He was a nation in his own right, and the smooth functioning of the national constitution that recently saw the election of the current judiciary chief, Ayatollah Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, as the eighth president of the Islamic Republic, is indebted to the justice-seeking personality of this great Iranian jurisprudent, philosopher, and a statesman, whose life was cut short in the prime of manhood at the age of 53 by U.S. regime agents. For the past 2 years, Raisi, who 4 decades ago was a young protege of Islamic Iran's one and only Chief Justice, has commendably discharged his duties, including his long stint in various judicial positions in defense of human rights. He is now all set to play the role of Chief Executive, with a resolve to promote the goals of the Islamic Republic at home and abroad, for the benefit of nations determined to defeat American hegemony. This is indeed the fulfillment of the aspirations of Martyr Beheshti, whose vision as a loyal disciple of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had seen the dignity and humanitarian values of the Islamic Republic inspiring the eventual triumph of truth in the region. And of course, Islamic unity, including the campaign for liberation of Al-Aqsa and Palestine from the Zionist yoke. As Ayatollah Beheshti used to say, the Islamic Republic system is designed for the betterment and evolution of humankind, and one of whose most important pillars of political thought was that humans could walk in the right path along with faith towards truth. Today, Iran is steadily marching towards the peaks of progress by mastering almost all fields of modern science and technology, and in the process, assisting nations to break free from the devilish yoke of the U.S. regime.
Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The U.S. has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the U.S. aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister, Faisal Maqdad, has said the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of U.S. imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fiolin. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine, Yes, of course, the United States and the UK are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the schools subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson? And is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980, with activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
The United States has launched a wide-scale cyber crackdown on the websites of major news networks, mainly based in West Asia. In what appears to have been a coordinated operation, the domain for the websites was seized at a similar time late Tuesday night. Viewers visiting the sites have been met with the same notice from the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which reads, "This website has been seized, the domain has been seized by the United States government." The alleged legislation stated in the notice is too vague and wide to pinpoint exactly why the sites have been targeted. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, a total of 36 websites have been seized. Among the most prominent websites of news networks that have been targeted are Iranian-based news channels Press TV, Al Alam, and Al Kothar. In Yemen, the popular Al Masira news outlet that has been documenting Saudi Arabia's war on the country, along with other regional developments, has also been seized. Palestine Today is another, and the website of Lu'lu'a TV, an independent Bahraini news channel, was also captured. Washington took control of sites linked to news channels based in Iraq, too. These are mainly associated with the country's most important anti-terrorism security force, the Popular Mobilization Forces, the same branch of the Iraqi Armed Forces that spearheaded